You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at armorall.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hello and welcome to the Bike Radar podcast, brought to you from the team behind Cycling Plus, MBUK and BikeRadar.com.
Hello, welcome to the Bike Radar podcast. I'm Tom Marvin, one of the technical editors at Bike Radar. Today we're speaking to Benedikt Skulason, who is the CEO and founder and engineer at Lauf Bicycles. So it's going to be quite an interesting chat. We're going to talk about Lauf, their gravel bikes, their new gravel bike that we've just been riding, as well as sort of how the whole company came about, how they developed things, and looking at the gravel scene in general as well. So, Benny, how are you getting on?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you. A bit beat up after yesterday's ride, to be honest. But it was a wake-up call, good wake-up call, start of a season.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. Now, where were we riding yesterday?
So it's actually, in English, we could have guessed the conditions because it's called the swamps, basically.
The swamps, okay.
Yeah, Mýrarnar in Icelandic, so it's the swamps. And in the summertime, it is dry and fast, but it was heavy yesterday.
It was pretty boggy in places. I think described how the top surface of the road has thawed out a little bit. There's some ice frozen sort of 10 centimetres underneath, and there were certainly times when it was pedalling through treacle.
Exactly. So, but it's a nice area. There is like good scenery and stuff. And so it's, just an hour away from here, Reykjavik, southwest.
Cool. And the day before we did a quick 50k sort of warm up lap somewhere else, which was very windy.
Yeah. That's the typical weather around here.
We went up one side of a valley with quite a savage cross headwind. But to be fair, we sort of turned right over a bridge to sort of cross the other side of the valley, and all of a sudden we almost tripled our speed. No discernible increase in effort.
And I like instantly realized that, this is why I love this sport. I was like, shit, what are we doing here? Yeah. And I'm like, now I remember.
The fun bits.
The fun bits.
We could go
then fast. The day after, I had like none of those bits. It was just like pedaling through mud for 5 hours, 6 hours.
It was a lot of pedaling, non-stop pedaling, I think.
Yeah. But it's like gravel. Gravel is everything.
Yeah.
It's all things.
Yeah, exactly that. So what were we riding? So we're here for the launch of the Segler. So we'll talk a bit more in depth about the new bike in 5 or 10 minutes time. But brief summary, give us the highlights of the new bike.
Of the bike. So it's easiest to describe it like relatively compared to our True Grit.
Okay.
So it's basically this bike is all about like maintain. So we don't want to, what we absolutely did not want to do was to make a drop bar mountain bike.
Okay.
Because there's like, there's nothing special about that, we think. What we wanted to do was to make like a gravel bike as fast and as like nimble feeling as the True Grit, but with like loads of tire clearance.
Mm-hmm.
So loads of tire clearance. And then also, I mean, what people have been talking about the True Grit is that obviously, yeah, we have our forks there in the front that people might be familiar with, that give like, much more comfort in the front than what we had in the back of the True Grit. And we wanted to balance that out a bit as well. So we like designed this system for the rear triangle of the bike, basically, and the top tube to give some compliance there.
Okay.
Could talk about it for hours, but like the essence of it is the True Grit, just with loads of more tire clearance and more compliance at the rear.
Okay.
So that's basically, that's a highlight.
A more comfortable gravel race bike.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe for a bit of context for our listeners who maybe aren't aware of Lauf, the brand, I guess the best known product is the Grit SL fork, which is a 30 millimeter leaf sprung gravel suspension fork. We'll talk about the evolution of that in a minute, but if you want to get more information on the Lauf True Grit, that was my bike rider long-term bike in 2021, so there's plenty of information on there as well as reviews of that, and of course the new Segler. There are news stories and a first ride review at the very least on Bike Radar as this is released, so it'd be worth having a read of that. Head to bikeradar.com. You'll find the pod plug for this podcast on there with all the links that you're going to need. But yeah, so let's start at the beginning, Benny. Then we don't need a life story, I guess, but we first sort of met probably 6 or 7 years ago with the TR Boost launch. Yeah. So you had a 60 mil mountain bike, XC Marathon fork. And we came out to the launch of the Boost version of that, and we learned a bit about the brand from there, and things have obviously developed. So tell us a little bit about where you've come from, and how you came up with the concept of leaf sprung suspension.
Yeah, so I mean, honestly, we were like all along we were trying to make a gravel fork, but there were no gravel bikes back then. So Icelandic perspective on this. So Icelandic mountain biking back then. So this is 11 years ago. So it's almost a life history. It's a big part of my life, at least by now. So back then, I mean, mountain biking was basically gravel riding.
Yeah.
So the biggest race in Iceland is what you would definitely like classify as a gravel race today. Mm-hmm. And that was the biggest mountain bike race here. So they, to me, cycling was just that race. And like performing as well as possible in that race, that was my goal. So that was my thinking basically behind that fork. So I'm an engineer. And I was fascinated by composites just in general. So which is carbon fiber, glass fiber, that stuff, Kevlar and whatever. Basically, so my love for enthusiasm for composites, just the things you can do with them, it's incredible. That landed me a job after I graduated, landed me a job with Össur, which is a prosthetic company. They make prosthetic feet. Because that was like the only company in Iceland making anything like high end out of composites.
Okay.
So I started working there, but it didn't last long because like before I knew it, I had been witnessing what is possible with prosthetic feet. I mean, how much you can make them flex the carbon feet. And I was like, shit, okay, the bike industry is getting it somewhat wrong here. They're only using this to make stuff light. While I was seeing at work, like doing like 2 million cycles on a foot, like a massive deformation, like shit, okay, this, we must take advantage of this somehow.
Yeah.
Which led to the first concept of the Lauf fork, which we applied for a patent for, got that patent eventually. Mm-hmm. And then it just has been, a labyrinth, the way around obstacles and trying to overcome. Mm-hmm. Thanks. Ever since, so 11 years later, still here.
Here we are.
Yeah.
So the fork itself, well, there's two legs that come out of the front and they project further forward than a traditional, suspension fork leg, and then there are two sort of dog bone shaped rear links that are connected to those front legs with a dozen glass fiber springs.
Yeah. So it. To the eye, it probably looks, it even looks heavy probably because there's like more surface on it than a suspension fork, but it's like, it's crazy light in comparison. It's almost like half weight and it looks complicated probably to some as well. But that's like our main ethos is like simplicity, basically. If you really look into it, that fork, it doesn't have any moving parts. Mm-hmm. So I think trying to like go more and more into that, like our hunt for simplicity is going like further and further to gain some like performance in the bike without doing something that requires maintenance or, or adds weight.
Pivots and bushes friction and things like that.
Yeah, and like the rear compliance on the Sigla is like the perfect example of that. And also actually the handlebars we've had for a few years now.
The smoothie bar.
The smoothie bar, yeah.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, they look like completely like unremarkable. It's just a handlebar. But like they really do something more, more than other bars. They really have compliance built into them without making something like weird and like gimmicky into
sure.
it. And then we have like the same thing going on at the rear now on the Sigla.
Yeah. So we've got the TR Boost mountain bike fork with 60 mil travel, which you say was sort of built to tackle Icelandic mountain biking, which in effect was, I guess, gravel riding.
Yeah.
And then the gravel bike boom kind of happened 6-7 years ago, things like really exactly. kicked off. So were you at that point, were you sort of like rubbing your hands with joy that, hang on, we've got this product? Or did it take how did you move on to creating the next product, which was the grip fork?
Yeah, it was a bit like that. We were like almost just standing there with that product in our hands and like, now we have the application for it.
Uh-huh.
Because like the issue had been that, I mean, we got like raving reviews from some. They like absolutely loved the mountain bike forks because they were doing gravel riding on it.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, that was never a major market. And all those that like reviewed it and intended it to be or thought it was supposed to be a mountain bike, like all out mountain bike fork, they hated it because it's not that.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, like you had a bike with a drop bar that like screams, this is not a mountain bike.
Yep.
So nobody's going to expect mountain bike like performance traits in it. So all of a sudden it was just like spot on. And that was, yeah, we acted fast in like downsizing the concept to make it fit gravel bikes.
Okay.
And ever since, so this was in 2015-16 that we made the first gravel fork.
Yeah.
And ever since, it's been like all about gravel, basically. Then we became a gravel bike company in late 17.
Mm-hmm. And that was with the launch of the True Grit. So you had the Grit SL fork, which was a 30 millimeter sub-kilo suspension fork designed specifically for gravel, you know, like a gravel axle. Is it a 15x100mm axle with, was it post mount or was it flat mount at that point?
Flat mount from the start. There was a fresh standard then, so we were like
straight
one of the first
it.
Two, yeah.
And then, yeah, so say then in 2017, you bought out the True Grit, which I think you emailed me about, you had a product launch coming up or something, and we weren't expecting a fork company to bring out a bike. It was a bit of a, was it a step into the unknown for you guys doing that? What made you think, hang on a minute, we can do this?
Not so much. Yeah, exactly. It was like we had like an epiphany, basically. So all of a sudden we just realized that, hey, we had learned everything that needed to be learned to make a full bike, because we had been like working with composites for all this while and making the fork. And the fork is in itself a much more complicated like product than a bike frame.
Okay.
A bike frame is more like, I mean, it's all known. It's all standards, basically. Mm-hmm. Then you just like piece them together the way you want them. So you don't really need to invent anything like straight out there. So like technically we realized that it was relatively easy, and the fact that we had been then for a couple of years like putting our gravel fork on all these different gravel brands, so we like unknowingly we had been studying the market like like pretty like massively. We had been riding everything that was out there.
Okay, so you were buying bikes from different brands and putting the Grit SL fork on there
without ever like having the intention of making a bike frame.
Okay.
But this was just like a part of doing the fork and trying it out and making it fit this bike and that bike. But it was always like, there were a lot of factors like pushing for that bike. For instance, it was always annoying to make our forks comply with like all the different bike frames, all the different head tubes and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But like when we moved to our own bike, we could finally like make the fork we wanted.
Okay.
I mean, for example, just like the head tube, the shape of the head tube,
mm-hmm.
the steer tube on the fork.
Mm-hmm.
We could completely decide how that should be. Like, have like an integrated crown race and do all the things that just make it a better fork, but at the same time maybe eliminates the compatibility with some other brands. But at this point, we don't care, which is super nice.
Yeah, okay. And so talk us through the concept then of the True Grit. There have been a few race-specific gravel bikes. The 3T Explorer is possibly the one that's maybe best known for that, you know, an actual aero gravel bike. But I guess a large portion of the gravel market, certainly that we see in the UK, is a bit more sort of for the adventure. You know, there's lots of mounts on them. They're kind of a bit more sit-up and comfortable, in inverted commas. Whereas the True Grit is, you know, certainly you described it as a race bike.
Yeah. I mean, we are definitely, so I would say like the bikes that influenced us were the likes of, yeah, you mentioned the 3T Explorer. And obviously, when you think of that bike, you think of the Open Up from the same guy, basically. And then you had the Niner RLT RDO carbon bike and the Salsa Warbird. So these bikes, basically, but without like putting them down. Mm. I mean, with all of those bikes, there were things that we didn't like.
Okay.
Because it didn't fit our needs or desires. So we basically took what we liked the best from these. And then what we did that was pretty, almost like radical at the time. We infused like more mountain bike DNA into the bike than the others. So, which at the time meant, a slacker head angle, longer top tube, shorter stem.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, so the thing is, it's like a balance act. So we wanted to make a bike that is stable, but at the same time, it should be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you do that? Is that our way of doing that is like, choosing where it should be stable. So to us, it's really important that it's stable up front.
Mm-hmm.
But in the rear, not so much. I mean, you can gain stability by lengthening the chainstays, obviously. Yeah. But by making them shorter, you make it more lively.
Mm-hmm.
And by making it lively in this way, you're not compromising on downhill confidence as much as you would be if you make it like lively in the front.
Okay.
So it's that balance. I think we did that significantly, differently from others.
Sure.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
One of the things I sort of wanted to know is, as a, you know, Lauf is, it's a small company, and I don't know, I don't think that's a fact that can, you know, it's, you know, there's a team of what, 10 of you, 7, 8, 10,
give or take,
So, and you're obviously very, very connected to the product itself. You know, you've designed it, you run the company, the people you work with are, because it's so small, everyone is so connected. How do you, this is slightly different from what we're talking about, I guess, but how do you deal with sort of any criticisms? How do you take that? Is it a personal thing or?
Criticisms.
Like say the TR, you know, the mountain bike fork.
Yeah.
When some maybe less favorable reviews came out. Was that like a?
I mean, as long as it's like true, I mean, we just try to build on that. I mean, of course, we never had issues with any like I mean nobody has been like unfair to our products that I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as long as it's like that, it's just something to build from. Mm-hmm. I guess. So and thankfully, I mean, like the mixed reviews they came in at first, and I mean obviously we just didn't know what we were doing well enough. I mean we were a young company and it was our first product.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously it wasn't gonna like hit all the right notes right away. So, but thankfully, I mean, we haven't had much of criticism over the last few years. It's been pretty much solid. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. You've been enjoying them?
Yeah, I've been, basically, yeah. And that's how I deal with it, yeah. I enjoy it.
So obviously, the True Grit has been, I think it's fair to say, quite a successful bike for you guys. It's certainly pretty big in the US with sort of the gravel scene out there. You know, you're sponsoring some big races this year, the Gravel Worlds.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's necessarily fair to say that the True Grit has been without some criticism. Certainly as, and I think it's probably more come to light as gravel as a discipline has evolved, because, you know, gravel is still fairly new, right? And, you know, the rate of change of how gravel bikes are developing has been really fast. And so I wouldn't say that the True Grit has been left behind at all, but I think some of the criticisms have come to light in recent years, and those would be relatively limited tire clearance at the rear, skinny seat tubes, and I guess these things have led to the developments and the changes that we've come to see with the Segler.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, tire clearance, when the True Grit came out, like, that was considered massive, the tire clearance on it.
As well, 45C clearance, shipping with 40s.
Yeah, that was big at the time. At the time, they were shipping, most other bike brands were shipping with 35s or so. And 40 was considered big back then. So I think, like, the gravel, the way it has evolved, I think, is that back then, people were still, like, thinking of capable road bikes.
Mm-hmm.
And the bike, I mean, as shipped, the bike should be able to fit into a group ride, mm-hmm. a group road ride, basically. Mm-hmm. So back then, I mean, all your friends were riding road, and you probably like having friends, so you wanted to ride with them rather than just always being out on your own.
Yeah.
But what's happening now is that, I mean, your friends are now riding gravel. So now gravel is its own thing.
It's a distinct genre, yeah.
So it can, like, finally, it's free, so to speak.
Yeah.
We can, like, be lyrical, but yeah.
Yeah.
It's free. So now we can make the best gravel bikes there can be without, like, needing to, like, stick to the road thing too much. I mean, we should hold on to the good stuff from road. I mean, the fast position on the bike.
Yeah,
I think.
Snappy handling. Yeah.
But still, like, infuse that with enough stability up front.
Mm-hmm.
And fit it with the tires that are fastest. And we know this, like I mentioned earlier, the Blue Lagoon Challenge here. So in that race, I mean, it's been a huge event here, like with 1,000 participants every year, which is a lot in a country this small. It's like 1 out of 300 Icelanders takes part.
Yeah.
So that's pretty crazy. So people have known there for years that like for that event, it's like 2 to 2.1 inch wide tires, 29ers. They roll the fastest in the gravel there. And it's fairly rough gravel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. I mean, the wider tires just become faster as the gravel gets a little bit rougher.
Yeah. And so that's where we come then with the Segler. Segler. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
My Icelandic is not what it once was. I guess, you know, one of the first things I sort of really noticed with the True Grit when I first rode it, or even it might have been on the when we had the grip fork, was having that compliance at the front of the bike highlighted that you didn't have it at the back.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the Segler then. It's not replacing the True Grit, but it's gonna at the moment sit alongside it.
Yeah.
And I guess over time.
Yeah, it will take over eventually.
Eventually, but there's no rush for that.
No, there's no rush. I mean, the True Grit is still doing very well.
Yeah.
So,
going to fit. There's going to be a lot of people who want that sort of the skinnier tire, the more road.
Yeah, the more classical aesthetics, maybe the higher seat stay look. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it has drop seat stays, which obviously has been a massive thing in road cycling and in gravel bikes. You know, drop stays are sort of the thing for the past couple of years. But
yeah.
I hadn't really sort of considered a huge amount about how it works or why it works or which bits exactly flex and all that sort of stuff. But you described it on Monday night when we were sort of looking at the bike for the first time, you know, what's flexing where. So do you maybe want to sort of talk us through this, the engineering, the bike, but the engineering of a drop stay and how it works?
Exactly. Yeah. My pleasure. So the thing is, I mean, like you say, I mean, it's been super popular on road bikes for a long while now to drop the seat stays. And this is almost exclusively for aero-ness. But what you can also do when you drop them is to use that to get compliance. And this is similar to, I mean, you've seen bikes like the Trek Isospeed bikes, Cannondale with the Kingpin. The
Topstone,
exactly, yes. And more bikes that rely on basically the seat post flex.
Mm-hmm.
The saddle can like move back and down a bit to give you some compliance. And by dropping the seats, if you do it like, as I would say, correctly, if you drop them a bit and then you make sure to accommodate for some twist at the top tube seat tube junction.
Okay.
So if you have like a slim back portion of the top tube, mm-hmm. and preferably like we have a standard seat clamp.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have like an integrated seat clamp that like bulks up that junction and okay. stiffens it up. So if you have like a skinny rear end of the top tube, yep. where it meets the seat tube, they get like a virtual pivot basically out of that. So you basically get the ISO speed pivot without actually having a pivot.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and whenever you like put weight on the rear of the bike, or mm-hmm. when you have like a big force into the rear tire and under the rear tire, that's channeled into the seat stays.
Yeah.
That then push the seat tube inwards. So okay. the seat tube gets bent a little bit.
Bows inwards.
Yeah, bows inwards, yeah. and that makes the saddle to tilt backwards.
Yeah.
And from that you get increased comfort.
Okay, because you get both a rearward and a vertical displacement of the saddle.
Yes, yeah. But the thing is, you can't do too much of this. This has like a limit.
Okay.
Because it's like there's some undesired movement in there as well. So the back and forth doesn't do anything for you.
Okay.
Because, I mean, the forces that are coming from the ground, they come straight up.
Sure.
And your back and forth movement doesn't help anything like in dealing with that.
Uh-huh.
So like in this configuration, like when you're using seat post flex, you always get them, yeah, the both of them, backwards and downwards.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do too much of this, it will give you tons of comfort, but then you'll just like being pushed too far back.
Okay.
And like the position on the bike gets weird, and then it's too much funk basically.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, so it's like units of comfort per unit of funk basically.
Uh-huh.
So what we do on the cycle actually, we play around with that ratio basically. We get more comfort per unit of funk, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
by tilting the seat tube. So it's like you see it immediately when you look at the bike in profile.
Mm-hmm.
So we push the seat tube forward and then tilt it back.
Yeah, so the base of the seat tube is further forward of the BB than it is on the true grit.
Yes, exactly. So it doesn't like, so this wouldn't be UCI legal, because in UCI you need to be able to draw a line from the center of the bottom bracket.
Sure.
And up to the top of the seat tube. So that's probably the reason it's not done on bikes.
Right, okay, yeah.
Yeah, and gravel bikes are still like limited by their like association with road bikes.
Sure.
So people think they should look like that.
Yeah.
But like doing this gives you, yes, significantly more comfort in the bike,
mm-hmm.
While it also like limits the rear movement,
right, okay.
associated with it.
Yeah, yeah, because you get more of a vertical component because it's slacker.
Yeah, because it's tilted back. So sure. It's actually, I mean, the effective seat angle is standard. It's the same as on true grit, 72.5 yeah. degrees. But like the actual like slope of the seat tube on this bike. So
yeah.
First it's offset and then it's like tilted back to 69.9 degrees.
Right, okay.
So it's significantly slacker.
Yeah. So this is something that, you know, like our mountain bike listeners will be very well versed in, the difference between
yeah.
actual seat angle and an effective
exactly.
seat angle. But, you know, yeah, maybe the road cyclist it's a less common measure to talk about effective seat angle
yeah.
because
yeah.
of so, okay. And we're using like an inline postal now, we're not bothering with a layback or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly. No, yeah. To me, it just doesn't look efficient to have a setback post.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like it's taking like a detour towards where it wants to get.
There are two other sort of, if you're looking at the new bike, there are two other areas which are potentially interesting. We'll talk about the slight changes to the fork because it's
minimal.
They're nominal, but
yeah.
there's changes that have been made.
Yeah.
But I guess the other sort of thing that stands out is the chainstay bottom bracket junction. You have
yeah.
a huge carbon plate joining the two.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we do basically, so as we described, or I described earlier, is that we wanted to like fit the maximum tire in the bike.
Yeah.
Without making it longer in the rear. So
okay.
it's still the same short 425 chainstay.
Right.
Which is
shorter than like a lot of endurance road bikes even.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's shorter than most of the other gravel bikes
mm-hmm.
in the market. But still we're able to fit like significantly wider tires than those. And that's because we do a few things. Like you say, we have the chainstay on the drivetrain side. It's solid now.
Okay.
So it's a solid plate inside of it. So there's no hollow segment there. So that frees
so it's
up.
Thinner in depth.
Yeah. So it's about 6 millimeters in width
uh-huh.
rather than 9.5, which was already like pushing it
yeah.
on the true grit. It was 9.5. So that, like, yeah, that buys us 3.5 millimeters, like times two, obviously, because it's like on the other side as well. Yeah. So that gives us a ton of clearance. And then also we like completed the step of just like, yeah, completely abandoning front derailleurs.
Right.
And in doing so, because I mean, nobody was riding them on our bikes. We only spec'd one bike. And like at first, I mean, we had a lot of customers that like wanted to fit a 2x2 with them, wanted us to add that spec, but it's less and less and less. Mm-hmm. So the market is basically coming to where we have been with that.
Okay.
Which meant that we could like completely eliminate it, and then we don't need to like reserve these 2.8 millimeters that we would otherwise have to for an inner chainring. Mm-hmm. So those two things, yeah. Plus the fact that we use a slightly wider BB.
Right, you're using a BB 73.
Yeah, BSA 73. So that buys us 5 millimeters more in tire clearance. Mm-hmm. So all these things added up, I mean, you can fit a 2.25/29 in there.
Yeah.
So which is, yeah, to me, I mean, it's pretty, yeah.
It's a big tire, yeah. So, yeah. It's pretty tight in there with that tire, but yeah. So maybe our UK listeners might want to consider a slightly narrower winter because it will clog, but
yeah.
You can easily fit, you know, we've ridden them with 50C tires in there, 700x50, and
yeah, it's like
plenty of room.
Space for that, yeah.
Sure, okay.
So this, like the spec, so the 2.25, you still have about 6 millimeters, like at the yeah, where the marginal is the lowest.
Sure.
You still have 6 millimeters of space, which is sort of like the required space to have around the tire.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
And speaking so of this, of the vertical displacement, you know, all this has culminated in giving this comfort, and you're saying it's about 4 millimeters.
So it's threefold compared to the True Grit. So basically, when I, like, yeah, admittedly not in race shape, but yeah, when I sit on this bike with my full body weight, basically it gives like 4 to 5 millimeters in flex.
Okay.
Like downwards, so measured downwards.
Vertical,
yeah,
flex.
Yeah, vertical, yeah, towards the rear axle.
Yeah.
While the True Grit had roughly 1/3 of that.
Okay.
And we've actually, without like mentioning like any particular competitors, but we like measured competitors that use like, yeah, mechanical solutions, and the end result is basically similar.
Okay.
Which is sort of what we were going for.
Yeah, yeah. But with no pivots and nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
Okay. In terms of the fork, I guess we can rattle through the changes there, but it's still 30 mil. The shoulders of the fork have been broadened to allow those bigger tires, and especially when the fork compresses, obviously, you need that space around there because you have to fit the tires in there. So it's got an axle to crown length that's 8 mil longer than previous, yep, but you've lopped 3 mil off the head tube, so it's about a 5 mil increase in stack.
No, 3 increase in stack.
Five mil off the head tube and three increase in stack.
Yeah, gotcha. True. So that, so it's like
marginal differences then.
Yeah, really. The stack is basically the same. Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. Within error margin. Almost.
Yes. And you can buy that fork aftermarket.
Yes. Yeah.
So you can stick it on your own bike in theory.
Yep.
Okay. Well, so that's the Segler, which we'll be reviewing on Bike Radar. So you can look out for reviews on that in the coming sort of weeks and months. Is it fair to look a little bit further forward? I want to talk to you about the general gravel market, where you see things going in the future. And I guess that ties in a little bit with a story that we reported on a couple of years ago, the patents that Lauf has, which is for a full suspension gravel bike.
Yep.
Using glass fiber springs. I'll put a link in the pod plug on Bike Radar so you can have a look at that. I don't think it's any secret that it's in the works.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I guess we were sort of half expecting that to have been launched this week, but it feels like the Segler's sort of, I don't think a stepping stone is the right thing, but how did you describe it? You described it as like the fruits of that development process.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is what came out of the process, like the R&D process behind like the full-blown rear suspension.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the rear suspension. So I talked about what you do on the Segler gives you a lot of like compliance in the rear, but like eventually we limited how far we can take it because it adds too much rearwards motion on the saddle.
Yeah.
And also if you want to do more, you would need to add like a bigger proportion of it at the axle rather than just the saddle. So you're not just like bouncing on top of the bike. Uh-huh. So that's what we're like aiming to do next.
Mm-hmm.
So give you even more compliance and do it more at the axle rather than the saddle.
Okay.
Which is even better, but that's like while it's like it's better suspension, but it's still it's more. I mean, it doesn't have like wearing parts, but it has like parts. Like there are more components to it. There's more weight to it. it's a more extreme bike.
Yeah.
And it will definitely be more polarizing. I don't see like a lot of stuff in the Sig Club becoming polarizing. I think, no. I mean, in my opinion, it's just like it's a logical next step.
Yeah.
From the other one.
Yeah. And it doesn't look particularly wild.
No, exactly.
It looks good. Like, you know, aesthetically, I think it's a good looking bike, but it doesn't look out there. Like when the Fork came out, you know, like that turns heads.
Yeah. There's nothing heavy to swallow basically there. It's just that, if you like the True Grit, I think you're going to love this. But like the rear suspension, that will be a bit more polarizing, which will be exciting.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to that, and we've made several prototypes. The thing is, it just takes far more time to develop that than we would have liked.
Yeah.
Because of many things. COVID hasn't helped exactly. It's harder to like visit vendors and like really push it through with them.
Mm-hmm.
And just like the load that has been on vendors, they've been in over their heads basically, supplying for the demand. And then also just the fact that, relatively to most of many bike companies, we're still small. We're way bigger than what we used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So now we cannot just like make something, like throw it into the market and then troubleshoot it.
Right.
Not that we did that like exactly, but I mean, to a degree, I mean, now we need to test way more.
Yeah, yeah.
If we would sell 2,000 rear suspension bikes, only to find out that in 3 years' time there's like a crack in the paint or whatever. I mean, that could be difficult.
Yeah. What is the process of bringing a new product to market? I mean, obviously, like this could be a podcast in itself. Yeah. So the bare bones, you know, how do you go from sort of drawing board to release?
I mean, it depends on, obviously, it's super dependent on what you're doing. So, I mean, as for the Sigla, it was like a relatively simple process.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's shapes changing. So we're not adding, of course, I mean, adding function, but still nothing that needed testing above the ordinary.
Sure.
Since we have the same geometry, actually, we honestly didn't need to test it that much for like the riding characteristics because they're mostly the same. Well, in like the rear suspension project, I mean, we want like a full year basically of just riding that and trying it out.
Okay. Just one of them, or we have like three or four?
Yeah, like a small fleet, for a few of them, definitely. Are you looking to get one?
I'm happy to. I'll put miles on bikes. Give me a little shroud to put around the junction so no one knows what it is.
And,
I'll rattle one around. Yeah,
you do that. Let's look into that. So, and then, I mean, then it's just the mold. So we have an excellent vendor in Asia, so they're exceptionally good. So we do all the 3D in-house here, and then they turn it into a mold, actually.
Okay.
And then, they design the mold around that shape, and they come up with the first, like, layup designs. Mm-hmm. So it was different for the Fork. For the Fork, we made, like, a big part of the layup design because it was very, like, unique to us.
Mm-hmm.
So we were, like, showing them how to make, like, the pockets for the springs and like, explaining how we wanted this and that.
Mm-hmm.
While with a bike frame, I mean, chances are that they are going to know better.
Sure.
Because they make like 500,000 frames a year or something many big brands and all. But it's always preferable to visit and point at the stuff. And then eventually sometimes they can come up with something even better when you like get their attention on stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But this process of from like our 3D drawings being complete, it can be like between 6 and 12 months until you get like a bike to ride.
Okay.
I mean, if you're able to like push play like right at the beginning, if you're sure that you'll manufacture that bike that you have in the drawing, you can probably do it in a little over a year or so.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a length of progress, a lot of twiddling thumbs.
Exactly. So if you take a project like the rear suspension one, so our next iteration will involve finishing another 3D and then like making the molds and making the bike and all that, only to find out that probably some detail we want to change afterwards.
Sure.
So we have like, they're like maybe 9 months or so for this prototype, and then we need to ride it for a bit, and then we have another 9 months, so it quickly adds up.
Yeah.
So we're looking at like 3 years or something, even though we have something that we already have stuff that is like very much rideable, but it's still something like this, three years.
And in 3 years' time then, where do you think the gravel market as a whole is going to be? Like it's developing so quick at the moment.
Yeah.
What are we going to see?
I think so. Maybe it's not just to push this bike, but I think it will gravitate towards something like the Sigla, which is, I think we shouldn't see tires getting wider than this. 2.25 is a lot of tire.
Yeah.
And it, like, I mean, to be honest, I mean, that tire, I'm not going to ride it on 2.25 every day. So I'll probably roll on 50s for the most part. And then when I go into a particular race that demands more, then I'm able to fit it.
Mm-hmm.
But like the trade-off is not always like beneficial when you go that high in tire width. So we're not going to see too much of that. Honestly, it's hard to tell. Mm-hmm. Because gravel things, it's gravel riding, it's so many things.
Yeah. It
depends on who
you
are.
It's very diverse from the bike packing all the way through to aero gravel bikes.
Yeah, exactly. I think, this, like the vanilla gravel segment will become this, I think, like the 45 to 50 millimeter tires, somewhat race able, somewhat comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have like the bike packing stuff, obviously, and aero gravel bikes, and it's gonna like it will be like a massive just spectrum of all things. There won't be a line like defining below this line is a road bike and above it is a gravel bike.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at I know the Trek road bike, some of them can fit basically gravel tires.
Yeah.
So I mean, is it a gravel bike? Is it a road bike?
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is, to me, this is what, one of the things that make gravel so interesting. It's like, nobody knows.
Mm-hmm.
It's just all over the place and depends on what you want. Honestly, it just depends on that particular, probably, race you are participating in, what gravel biking is. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Do you see any, on the product side of things, we saw the, it feels like one by is now pretty dominant in gravel bikes.
Yeah.
It feels like, you know, there's suspension products out there and that are definitely coming along as well from, you know, mountain bike manufacturers who are, you know, looking at the gravel market and thinking there's opportunities there. Is there anything that we haven't seen yet on the tech side that you think we will?
I think, rear suspension will be a thing. So I haven't seen I haven't seen new concepts popping up lately, but I'm sure, brands will try to push more into that, I'm pretty sure, because the advantages are significant.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's always like the fine art in gravel is like doing so without making it into a heavy mountain bike.
Right.
So that's, to gain something without sacrificing
something else.
Yeah. Basically. Okay.
The past couple of years have obviously been a tricky year globally for pretty much everything that's been going on. I'm lucky that I can speak to a lot of different bike companies from the biggest in the world to, you know, small one-man bands, you know, churning out very customized products. And you get a very different story in both positive and negative ways, depending on who you speak to, with regards to what's happened with COVID and supply chain issues and the growth in cycling and the demand and the pressures that that's created on everything from manufacturers like yourselves through to OEMs. As a smaller brand, but not tiny, I guess now, how have you managed to cope with it? What have been the challenges? What have been the opportunities? Has it been, you know, from a pure business sense and ignoring all the tragedies that have happened, you know, has it been a good couple of years for you guys, or has it been hard? You know, what's the story?
It's been so honestly, no one will ever know. So in our case, how much of it is like COVID related and how much of it is like what we ourselves have been doing, and our promotion and maybe our direct to consumer shifts.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, we've seen like massive growth over the last few years. It's been, this year is the fourth year in a row where we are doubling.
Okay.
I had admittedly starting from a fairly low point, but still it's getting significant, the growth. And to us, it's been, of course, it has been, I mean, it's a zero sum game, basically. For a brand like us, it's probably good that things are thrown up in the air a bit, because that like it levels the playing field in some ways, because like the established ones, they already have shit figured out, basically, and they're just like on that path. But whenever that path gets like smudged out, and then they like us need to find a new way forward, basically.
Yeah.
And then it's good for us to be a smaller and more dynamic company, so we were able to like act fast on things, so like commit to orders like quickly and way ahead of time,
Okay.
The trickiest thing has been drivetrains for the most part. Mm-hmm. We are very lucky with our suppliers in general. But like drivetrains, we were able to plan like very far ahead, and honestly, it's been running fairly smoothly for us. I mean, obviously, I mean, it's far easier to plan when like delivery time of a drivetrain is 30 days.
Sure.
As it was with SRAM. Now I don't know what it is. I mean, it's maybe a year or year and a half or something now. But like I said, I mean, it's the same for all the others.
Mm-hmm.
And if we tackle it better than them, it's actually a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
So end of the day, actually, I mean, it has been tough, but the end result has been very good. So okay. So probably it has worked in our favor.
Yeah. One of the things that's always struck me, and I don't know if it's in the wrong way, but, you know, when I've talked to you about, you know, your stuff, whether there's a pinch of sort of, you know, you're trying to sort of show the brand off in a positive light and stuff, but it feels like you've had good access to and relationships with some of the biggest OEMs. On the way here, we were chatting about the shift from a 68, BSA 68 to a 73mm bottom bracket shell and how SRAM, you know, may well have had one by cranks with longer axles in the works, but you asking for them kind of, it maybe prompted them to supply them to you.
Yeah.
You're a small brand, and yet that sort of story implies that maybe you have a little bit more influence than maybe your size would suggest. Do you think having a product that came to market that was pretty out there and is still utterly unique gives you an advantage or a benefit, or gives you sort of a slightly bigger standing when it comes to those OEMs? Rather than churning out like a generic Taiwanese frame, or whatever it is.
I think it gives us some, I like to think that it gives us some credibility that mm-hmm. we came up with something that nobody believed in, only to turn out, successful, a few years later. And basically to be a brand that is trying to go their own way,
mm-hmm.
and figure some stuff out. And in the case of SRAM, thankfully I think we are very well in tune with one another. So we are very well suited to what SRAM is making. We are mm-hmm. all about the simplicity of one by, the simplicity of their wireless stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a happy marriage that way. It just works,
mm-hmm.
works fluidly. So I'm happy that, I mean, some guys at SRAM are riding our bikes.
Okay.
That I know of. And obviously this probably helps. I mean this is like a relatively easy thing for SRAM to do,
sure.
to make a longer. I mean relatively, but still it's not trivial.
Mm.
Things need to be tested, etc. Mm. Even though it's just a longer axle in a crank, but it's still a change.
Machining has to be made for new parts.
And it's a skew into the catalog and all that. So maybe some credibility from having pushed the boundary before, and this is. I mean, they were already making some other like wide axle cranks, but mm-hmm. just not the most high end ones.
Mm-hmm.
So we like maybe opened their eyes to the fact that those would become in demand.
Mm-hmm.
So they put their money on that. And also, I mean, obviously, I mean, for them, it's probably it's an added benefit, and that doing so means that we are not compatible with Shimano GRX.
Right.
Yeah. So
Okay.
So it's a win-win relationship. Yeah. I think.
Excellent. Well, I think we'll. We'll tie it to a close there, mostly because I've run out of questions.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time chatting to us today. And thanks for hosting us out here. It's been a good couple of days. We've done some good riding, and certainly looking forward to riding the bike quite a lot more in the coming months. For Bike Radar listeners, you know, don't forget that you can find out a lot more about the new Segler bike on bikeradar.com. And also, there's plenty of information about the True Grit as well, and the Grit SL fork on there as well. If you haven't subscribed to the Bike Radar podcast, please do so. And if you can leave us a review, if you've enjoyed the podcast, that would be great. It really helps us grow the podcast and reach new audiences. So yeah, thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you.
Super. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for listening to the Bike Radar podcast. If you want any more information on what we've been talking about or more news and views on cycling, check out bikeradar.com.